Welcome back to the Tank Me Later podcast, which is part of the Fantasy Basketball International Podcast Network. I'm Noah Rubin. This is episode 51, and today we're going to be talking about the Pistons, the Wizards, and the Trailblazers with the Dynasty GOAT himself, Matt Lawson. So let's go ahead and get into it. All right, and quickly, before I bring Matt in, just wanted to let you know that support for this Fantasy Basketball International podcast is brought to you by Manscaped, who is the best in men's below-the-waist grooming. Shaving your jewels doesn't have to be risky business anymore, thanks to the Lawnmower 5.0 Ultra. This trimmer is all about keeping things smooth and safe, so you can trim with confidence, treat your wrinkle berries, and join the 10 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped by going to manscaped.com to get 20% off plus free shipping with code FBI. With Manscaped, it's easy grooming, no surprises. We know every dude gets the heebie-jeebies when it's time for a close shave down under, especially when using the wrong tools. That's precisely why Manscaped is my go-to for those delicate spots. Trust me, this trimmer will be your crown jewel's new best buddy. Get 20% off plus free shipping with the code FBI at manscaped.com. That's 20% off plus free shipping with the code FBI at manscaped.com. Show your balls some love and feel free as a dove. All righty. Now we can talk about some dynasty hoops. So I'm going to bring in the legend himself, Matt Lawson. Matt, we were just talking before we started this. This is normally when most fantasy analysts take a break, but this is actually your busiest time of year, as is the case for many dynasty analysts, but specifically for you trying to manage all of your leagues.
Yeah, this is dynasty season. This is where we kind of say goodbye to all the redraft folks. They're going to pop in maybe during the draft, take a little peek around in free agency, but we'll mostly see them come back in October. We're doing the real work now. As dynasty managers, whether it's you're running leagues, you're in leagues, you are getting things set up for the next championship campaign, because the real work begins in the offseason where you get the advantage over everyone else. Most people's takes are going to be locked in from what they thought during the season. They're not going to really think a lot about fantasy basketball for the next stretch of months, but the real dynasty managers who know what they're doing are going to be doing that work all off season. And that's why we're here, because we're going to start doing that work just like we did a year ago. I was listening to our podcast that we did 1 year ago, talking a little bit about some of the worst teams in the NBA. Let me tell you right now, one of them is still on this list of one of the worst teams in the NBA. But I think we nailed it. We talked a little bit about the Pistons, the Rockets, and the Spurs. And I was ready to cringe. I was ready to feel like I had led people astray, but I think point over point, we really nailed the analysis. So folks watching and listening at home, you are in good hands on this podcast. We're going to lead you to the promised land again this year.
I remember the conversation that we had specifically talking about the Spurs and saying, you know, Zach Collins may, like you were saying, Zach Collins was going to start whether they drafted Wemby or not. And he started beginning the season, obviously didn't pan out as well as I think we were all hoping for, because he was a guy I was really high on in redraft leagues as well heading into this year. But obviously Wemby changes things. So hopefully, I mean, not hopefully, there is no Wemby in this draft class, but we can go ahead and start talking about some of these teams that frankly kind of stunk this season. So the worst team in the league was the Detroit Pistons. So just a brief recap. They went 14-68. They have a 14% chance at the first pick and 52.1% chance at just landing in the top four. Their projected picks are first and 53rd, but obviously that can fall a little bit with that number one pick based on how the lottery goes. I did like an overall team direction for each team with this offseason recap, just to kind of, you know, get an idea in my head of where is this team at. So I said this team is rebuilding, but they have franchise players, at least a franchise player in Cade Cunningham, and then you can add in Sar Thompson, Jaden Ivey, Jalen Duren, I would say as core young players that are part of this team. What are kind of your overall thoughts on, I mean, it was kind of a disaster season for this Pistons team.
So the Pistons are the team of my childhood. I don't follow them the way that I used to follow the league as a whole more now, but I did watch a lot of Pistons basketball this season. And I can tell you that Monty Williams did not watch our podcast last year, because if he had, he would have heard that it's not a great idea to try to play Cade Cunningham next to Killian Hayes and have Killian Hayes continue to break shots in the half court time after time. Not surprisingly, Killian Hayes is no longer in the NBA despite playing a shocking large amount of minutes, especially during that losing streak that they had through December. I will tell you right now that at this point, the one thing that I feel certain about this team is that Cade Cunningham is going to be an all-star. He's going to be a very, very good player for a long time for the Detroit Pistons. But beyond that, there is nothing on this roster that I think they necessarily have to build around. And they need to be open-minded to the fact that what they have potentially in Jaden Ivey, Ausar Thompson, and Jalen Duren may not fit together with Cade Cunningham. It might not fit on any future Pistons contender. And I think that's the biggest question that we have in Dynasty with this group of promising young prospects. What can we really project for them long term? How do they fit together? And are they going to need to be on a second team for it to be able to work for them? Because as we'll get into in a minute, I have some questions about the fit of this roster as it shapes up now. And I think what they do in this NBA draft is going to be extremely important for the future of the team, because it very may well be the second best player that they're going to have in their long-term core that comes from this draft.
Yeah, even with all the commentary on this draft being there's no true stars, somebody's going to work out. And Detroit does have the best chance to get their selection based on who's available. They could end up getting the number one pick. Good chance at that. The core piece, Cade Cunningham. So we've been doing a slow mock draft. It's been significantly slower because of some issues with the season ending and Fantrax kind of locking our mock drafts. So we had to wait about a week to get that started back up. But a slow dynasty mock draft. Cade Cunningham went 15th in that, which I think in my rankings, I haven't ever had him that low. I have him a few spots higher with my latest one, which was at the trade deadline. But your value from him is coming from generally well-rounded stats, but really assists, points, threes, free throw percentage are kind of his best categories for fantasy. What kind of leap can he take? Like, is it ready to happen next season?
Well, so I think we already saw it to a great degree. I mean, the problem that you often see in NBA analysis, even fantasy analysis, is that people stop paying attention to teams once they are no longer relevant. And the only time that people were paying attention to the Detroit Pistons was the beginning of the season when they were setting the NBA record for losses consecutively. After that point, from January 1st onward, Cade Cunningham played much, much better than he did at the beginning of the season. We need to remember that he played essentially nothing in his second season. He had about 12 games played in year two. So this really was Cade Cunningham's second season, and the point where you start to see players make that leap forward. After the All-Star break, we see 24.4 points per game from Cade, 2.4 threes, 4.9 rebounds, 7.6 assists, and 40% from three. And the shooting is really the thing that tells you why Cade is going to be so good. 41.8% on 91 step-back jumpers. He ended up being at 48.8% on pull-up jumpers. He's a maestro in the mid-range. He's able to get to that shot consistently and knock it down. This is really where we saw the shooting prospect of Cade Cunningham come to full fruition, and it was in a massive offensive role. I think a role that is too big really for almost any NBA player, and definitely too big for Cade. This team needs another secondary creator with Cade, because he can be such a good off-ball shooter. That can work extremely well. That's why the theory of him and Jaden Ivey works if Jaden Ivey becomes the prospect and the player that we hope he can be. He hasn't gotten there yet, but I still think that there's another piece, another creator that you can put next to Cade and have it work extremely well. The reason that I've shifted him down a little bit in my dynasty rankings, I have him at number 14, is because the volume of three-pointers is not where it should be for a player who is as good as the shooter as he is. Cade does not shoot an elite volume of threes yet. That may still happen, but the indicators have seen that trending down since his NBA career started and since we saw him at Oklahoma State. He's shooting more in the mid-range, less from three. And on top of that, we saw the steal rate decline significantly from his rookie year as well. So if you're not going to be getting the defensive stats quite the way that we thought, you're not going to get the volume of threes that we were projecting and hoping for, that brings him down a little bit. But we're still talking about a guy who was top 30 during the final couple months of the season in that post-All-Star period in fantasy production in both categories and points leagues. So at his age, that production level and what you can project for his role going forward, there's there's no reason not to have Cade Cunningham in your top 15 of dynasty assets. I think he's an awesome fantasy player, an awesome real life prospect, and I'm extremely bullish on him going forward.
Do you think that next season is a year that we could see him leap into, just looking at season long nine cap value, see him leap into the top 20 or even towards first round value? Or do you think that is still potentially another year away, depending on how they fill out this team?
I think that would take some significant progression in his fantasy stat set. I'd be more likely to see him as a player that you're taking in, you know, like that you're getting third round value for next season. That's about where he topped out in the second half of the season. There could be that leap if all of a sudden you see something like his steal rate jumping back up, or all of a sudden the volume of threes is coming back up, and that's pushing him up into the upper 20s of points per game. That's possible. We could see that fourth year leap from Cade. It is going to happen at a certain point. But my projection would probably be more similar to what we saw in the second half of the season this year, where you're looking at more of like a third round value.
Yeah. And moving on to his counterpart in the backcourt, Jaden Ivey, who they're trying to make that work together right now. In that mock draft, he went 71st. Outside the top 250 in his first two seasons in nine cap value. I was looking up some of his stats and watching some of his shooting just to see, like, kind of, you know, give myself a refresher on what his shot looks like. So 57.9% was his field goal percentage at the rim. And basically in every other, you know, whether it was in the paint, but not at the rim, mid-range, three, wherever else, it was 40% or worse. So a ton of success at the rim, which is kind of what we expected coming out of college from him. And the shot really hasn't been great. Like, I don't think it looks bad. And there are times that, you know, he's able to get hot, but that fit may not be great alongside Cade Cunningham if there's not a ton of space for Cade to operate when he has the ball in his hands. I guess you kind of have alluded to it a little bit, but do you think that this Ivy Cunningham backcourt can work?
So I think the problem here is Jaden Ivey's inconsistency, and it's haunted him since his 2 years at Purdue. He's never been a consistent shooter, and now in the NBA, we're seeing dramatic inconsistency with him at the rim. The 57% at the rim, that's, you know, it depends on different sites that you're looking at. That's 22nd percentile, and he was way above that early in the season. It looked like he had really made a leap. He's already shown ability to teleport straight to the rim. He's so fast, blows by anybody. He can get to a rim attempt as well as any young guard in the league. The problem is he could not finish as a rookie to save his life. And that is where he fell back to in the second half this year, after being well up into the 60% range at the rim through the first half of the season. It looked like he had really made a leap there. That fell apart. And we saw a nice stretch of shooting for a few weeks in January from him from three. And then in the post All-Star period, we were looking at 30% on six attempts a game, just killing them as a 3-point shooter down the stretch, a deep slump to end the year. And this is just kind of where it's been with Ivy, up and down, never been able to kind of be consistent in his approach, never been able to be consistent defensively. And unless he's going to shoot, or he's going to become hyper-efficient at the rim, if he's going to become like Ja Morant, become hyper-efficient at the rim, that's the way that we see this pairing with Cade Cunningham working, because of the rim pressure and gravity that Jaden Ivey could provide to a duo with Cade Cunningham. So an area where Cade isn't going to have strength. That's where it could work. Or if he just becomes a knockdown shooter. But it's becoming harder and harder to see that being the way that this plays out with Ivey, at least when it comes to knockdown shooting, based on the progression of his career. I still think he's going to be able to improve at the rim. I think that's where this can happen for him. I'm a little bit lower than where that mock draft had him. At this point, I've got him 89th in my rankings, because I think there is real downside for him to not be a long-term NBA starter. Because if you're going to be a shooting guard or a combo guard and you can't shoot from three at an above average level, it's difficult to be an NBA starter unless you're bringing elite defense, or if you're bringing elite rim pressure and rim finishing. We'll see if Jaden Ivey can get there, but he's kind of more in that boom or bust range as a prospect for me than I felt like he was last season when he was finishing up his rookie year. This was not the second season that I hoped for to be able to see from Jaden Ivey.
And if you're looking at his numbers, you know, he was, just based on Basketball Monsters nine cap values, he was a negative in every category across the board. Obviously, I think the scoring is an upside. If he's able to improve his shot, the three-pointers could be an upside. Average 1.6 this year. The assists were pretty good as a rookie with Cade not on the floor, but not as good with Cade back. The defense, like the production is really there. 0.7 steals, 0.5 blocks per game this year. The field goal percentage is bad. The free throw percentage is bad, or at least subpar. What categories do you see him taking a leap that could help his 9 cap value?
Yeah, I think it's going to have to come from a few things. He's going to have to become an elite scorer, and you're going to have to see the assists come back up closer to kind of what we saw in his rookie season when he had a little bit more on-ball opportunity. But that playmaking, it hasn't been effective enough for him to be able to warrant having the ball to the degree that he did during his rookie season. So that's going to need to be able to be a big leap. I don't see elite defensive stats coming from Jaden Ivey. His free throw percentage has never been strong, and that's not going to be where it's going to come from. And it's unlikely that he's going to be a big contributor in field goal percentage. So it's really going to have to come from points, threes, and assists if it's going to come from anywhere for Jaden Ivey. Those are going to have to be the categories that lead. And right now, I think we have some questions about whether he's going to be able to become the player that can lead in those categories that are a little bit more usage dependent. And if he can be the three-point shooter that he needs to be able to be more of an off-ball player.
And that could be something that happens in a different city for a different team than Detroit playing alongside Cade Cunningham, because that would help his assists out a little bit, I think, being kind of a lead ball handler. But we can move on to Asar Thompson, who was their rookie this year. The defense was obviously incredible for a rookie, especially. The rebounding was great. Obviously, you know, kind of writing about fantasy consistently, I'm seeing his box scores and the insane defensive numbers. There's a couple dunks, I think, early in the season that, you know, he was really good to start the year. And then I saw on Twitter I don't even know where this account came from, just randomly popped up on my Twitter and said, man, I can't believe we drafted Airball Man. And then I started watching some Asar Thompson jump shots before we did this. And I didn't realize how ugly some of these shots were, like just an insane amount of air balls. I guess watching more Pistons games than I did, that's something you recognize throughout the year.
Yeah. Asar Thompson had the most bad looking 3-point attempts in the entire NBA this year, shot 18.6% from three, and still took a good number of them, which actually for me is at least a sign of hope. The fact that he still was confident enough to continue to attempt threes, despite how bad it looked at times, and the work ethic that we know that the Thompson twins have that was pretty legendary through their years at Overtime Elite, that tells me that there's still hope here for an NBA team, the Pistons, to be able to make him into a functional catch and shoot 3-point shooter. Maybe it's strictly from the corners, but there's a possibility for that to happen. 37.5% on mid-rangers is at least tolerable, even if it's low volume. Like there's something there. And we saw it a little bit in his last season at Overtime Elite, where he was not this bad as a 3-point shooter on a decent amount of attempts. So I'm not giving up on that entirely, but if it's going to work with Asar Thompson, it's going to work because he's playing a role more similar to what his twin brother Amen Thompson was playing at the end of the Houston Rockets season, where he was functionally playing small ball center out there, and that worked for the Rockets spacing, and it allowed them to play up tempo and to take advantage of the athletic gifts that Amen and Asar have, play in transition, allow them to be able to rebound and immediately go, take it and go, because both of them have that ability. And then you begin to unlock the things that make them so good. The problem here is that when you have Jalen Duren in that starting lineup too, that doesn't really work from a spacing perspective. Those two are crowding each other out. Neither one of them is likely to project as a good or even average 3-point shooter in their career, even though I think it's possible for even Jalen Duren to be able to stretch it out to three at a certain point, as we saw that progression in his free throw shooting this year. I don't know if the two of them can work together, especially because Jalen Duren has struggled so much defensively in his first two seasons. It doesn't really work as a fit between the two of them. And I think right now, if I had to be the Detroit Pistons leadership and to be able to pick what I would go with going forward, it would be Asar Thompson, just because the upside is so great for what he could become with his frame, athletic gifts, and his skill level. I think that Asar could end up being a guy who has an Andre Iguodala-like career, but that's still a big leap. That's a great player. And I don't know if he's going to be able to get there, but I at least want to take that upside swing. With Jalen Duren, who I want to talk about kind kind of concurrently here. The problem is, I think offensively, you're seeing some really great flashes from him. He's one of the best rebounders in the entire NBA at a very young age, but defensively, he was so bad, and he was a huge reason why the Pistons were so bad this year. He was one of the worst starting centers in the league defensively. And given how athletic he is, you usually see some defensive potential, more defensive potential than this, even 2 years in from a center, if they're going to end up becoming a good defensive center. Now, he's been in an awful context. I don't think that's helped him in any way. But if I have some doubts about Jalen Duren working out long-term in Dynasty, working out long-term in the NBA, it's that if you're a non-shooter as a center, you cannot also be bad defensively. That's just not going to work. Even if he shows these passing flashes that he has, you know, that he improves as a shooter, maybe adds a mid-range game, that isn't going to work in the NBA to be a non-shooter and bad defensively from the center position. So I love Jalen Duren in fantasy. I love the stat set. I don't know if I'm sold on the player yet, but the third year is going to be vital for him. And we need to see growth from Ausar as well from an offensive perspective to be able to see how that fit could possibly work long-term.
Yeah. And with Jalen Duren, you mentioned the defense, and obviously with fantasy, we're separating the defensive stats from the actual defensive, like defense that's being played at times, which sometimes they go hand in hand, sometimes they don't. The block rate that Jalen Duren had in college was 9.9. Onyeka Okongwu was 9.8. Nick Claxton was 8.0. Having, I guess, obviously that's been very different in the NBA because Jalen Duren's blocks just haven't really been there. The traditional center stats of high field goal percentage, good rebounding and blocks, that hasn't necessarily been there. It's been a little bit of the blocks aren't there, but the free throw percentage is a little bit better for centers. Is there, I guess, outside of just the traditional center stuff, those three categories that I mentioned and not really turning the ball over, which is another, like, I guess, big man stat. Is there any upside for him to kind of do anything else in fantasy or just be so good at some of those categories that he's altering fantasy matchups at times?
Yeah, so the reason that I have Jalen Duren still at number 54 in my dynasty rankings is because of the stat set. And yes, it's unconventional that the block rate isn't that high. That could come back as he actually learns how to be able to play NBA defense, because he certainly has the athleticism to be a better rim protector than he is. The reason that I like him so much is because he made a dramatic improvement in his free throw percentage this year. And on top of that, his ability to pass and to be able to be a potential hub of offense offensively, that fits really well into the modern NBA. So that is the vision that you have of him, that he has higher assists than your usual NBA center, that the free throw percentage doesn't hurt you. And even for stretches this year, he had a free throw percentage for a month or two where it helped you during that time. That is what could make a big difference with him, because the rebounding could be league leading. He could become a bigger contributor in points with time. The field goal percentage is going to be strong. That's the makings of a really good fantasy center, even if it's a little unconventional that the blocks aren't where you would expect from a traditional big.
And with that mock draft, we had Ausar Thompson go 45th, Jalen Duren go 49th. You mentioned that Ivy and Duren, I guess, aren't necessarily, or outside of Cade Cunningham, anybody could be expendable if it's the right move. I think you would be leaning towards, based off what I've heard, Ausar Thompson would be closer to definitely keep than Ivy and Duren. So if we're looking at the draft, you know, potentially having the number one pick, but a very good chance that they're picking, you know, I think they can't slide outside of the top five, if I'm not mistaken. So they're going to have one of the first few picks of the draft. I mentioned a couple guys, or I guess I have listed a couple guys, Alex Saar and Zachary Risache, as hopefully I'm pronouncing that right. I guess I didn't verify that, but as a couple of targets that would make sense either because of fit or just because of talent. Is there anybody in particular that you think, okay, like this guy just needs to be in Detroit?
Yeah, the situation for the Pistons is very similar to last year. With the best odds, they have about a 50% chance to land one of the four lottery spots and be in the top four, or they are going to end up at number five again, like they were last season when they took Ausar Thompson. So it's a coin flip proposition. And that means they're going to get one of the top prospects in this draft. I think if they get number one, they're going to take Alex Saar. I think they should take Alex Saar. He has the best potential to be able to, the best combination of upside and fit into a long-term core that could work for this team going forward. Because Saar, I think while he didn't have the best three-point percentage this year, he was a willing three-point shooter. It's something that where he appears to have the touch to be able to develop into a solid three-point shooter and be able to space in the NBA. And it's the two-way impact. It's the ability for him to be able to slide his feet, to be able to guard up and down the lineup a little bit, and also rim protect at the same time. The rim protection numbers were strong coming out of the NBL. I really like Alex Saar. I think he could be perfect. You could play him next to Jalen Duren. He could be the long-term five for them if they don't think it's working out with Duren. But that would be my pick at number one for them. But beyond that, I don't think that there's a whole lot here that I would say, well, you can't draft that because you're drafting over, you know, a player that you already have that you can't, you know, that you don't want to be able to push out of opportunity. I'd be willing to take a Nikola Topic. And I know that might surprise people, but this is the same position that I had with LaMelo Ball and Scoot Henderson last year. Because Cade Cunningham is a shooter and because Nikola Topic's strength is being able to drive to the rim out of the pick and roll, they can both do that. They can be that other creator that they need. Have size as well because of Topic's size. I'm not counting that out as something that could be able to work for them because they need to be swinging for an upside player. They are not in a position to be able to be thinking, well, we need to add a 3-and-D wing. I don't even think Zach Risacher should be a top five pick at this point. I think a lot of the hot momentum around him is based on ESPN still having him at number one. The reality of his season is that for the last few months, he has completely flatlined as a three-point shooter. He was shooting, you know, north of like 45% to the beginning of the season, which was inflating the way that people viewed him as a prospect. But the rest of the profile and what we've seen more recently from him shows that the bottom is going to fall out pretty quickly if Risacher isn't going to be a knockdown three-point shooter. And I think that's difficult to be able to say. His free throw percentage doesn't suggest that he is. There isn't enough of a body of work to be able to say that he's going to be a 40-plus percent three-point shooter, that he's going to shoot with elite volume. So I can't take that at number one, even in a weak draft, to be able to give myself so little upside for what I'm getting in this draft. I think that there's a lot more upside in this draft beyond that. I'd be willing to consider Reed Sheppard here because of the shooting ability and just being able to add high feel players to a team that really lacks it beyond Cade Cunningham. I think that could make a big difference if they do drop down to five, for example. But for me, I think the Pistons need to be able to evaluate this pick from a best player available perspective rather than viewing it through the lens of, well, how do we fit around Jaden Ivey and Asar Thompson and Jalen Duren into a long-term core, and how do we thread that needle to make this next pick fit with those guys? We haven't seen enough for them to make decisions in that way. Not that I have any faith in the decision-making that we're about to have in Detroit. I guess we'll have to wait and see what front office leadership is going to be making the call in the draft this summer.
Yeah, when you're 14-68, it's kind of hard to not do anything other than best player available. But we're going to move on to talk about a team that was slightly better at 15-67, the Washington Wizards. Again, 14% chance to pick first, 52.1% to pick in the top four, and then the worst they can pick is sixth. Projected right now, they'd have pick second, 26th, and 50th. Their overall team direction, I have them as rebuilding without a franchise player. I don't think that if they're in the middle of a rebuild that they're superstars on this roster. Don't believe that. But there are certainly guys that think that they're the franchise player that have superstar upside on this roster. What'd you think about this Wizards season?
They were just as bad as I expected them to be. And I think they're honestly looking at where we are at with this roster. There is nothing on this roster that I'm confident is going to be on the next good Wizards team. I like Bilal Coulibaly. I think that he is an interesting two-way prospect with a potentially high ceiling based on some of the things that we saw this year. But in no way do I feel like that's a cornerstone that they need to be building around necessarily. I think that this draft will be vital for them to be able to, like the Pistons, take a high upside swing to be able to add something that will be part of the next good Wizards team. Because whether it's Jordan Poole or Kyle Kuzma, Tyus Jones, I don't expect these players to be part of the next Wizards team that makes the playoffs.
And we'll start with Coulibaly. He went 93rd in our mock draft. How good do you think obviously the defense has a lot of upside and he can be very, very good there. More of a player that you build with than build around, obviously, but how good can he be in fantasy basketball in your opinion?
So that's going to be interesting to see, because we saw this year a very limited role for Coulibaly. He shot mostly corner threes, wide open corner threes, shot pretty well on them, 39.7% on corner threes, and was wide open on almost every attempt that he took. Lots of cuts to the basket. He showed a good feel for that, of kind of having the timing of cutting in the NBA, which is a really good sign for him, and it helps because he's so athletic. The steals and deflections were solid. 60th percentile on deflections. You would hope for a little bit better, but you have to remember too, you know, coming into the NBA as a teenager and being able to have a feel for the timing to be able to deflect passes, to know when to jump passing lanes, that's a lot to expect. And I think that will improve with time, just given his physical tools and just over his overall defensive mentality. The upside here with him, and the, you know, the what we're really hoping for, is what he flashed driving to the basket. He averaged 4.9 drives per 75 possessions. That's 55th percentile. That's pretty good for a very raw offensive player who was playing in the lower levels of the French League until he was called up late to play on Mets 92 with Victor Wembanyama later in their season last year. And he shot 63.7% at the rim per basketball index. That's where you see some room for growth for him. If he's going to be able to attack closeouts, drive to the rim, you could have someone who can be a functioning component of the offense, especially if he's hitting corner threes at the level that he was. There's no passing ability to be able to show yet. I think in some ways, some of the comparison with Coulibaly, some of the upside, you're hoping for something like Herb Jones. Herb has more passing ability, and maybe that's something that can develop with Coulibaly, because I do see him as a high field player that he could eventually develop some ability to be able to cut to pass out of those drives. But I think we're a ways off on that. This is still pretty raw. The upside for fantasy really needs to come from him developing more in the defensive stat categories. Didn't really see that fully this season. And we did in the preseason. So maybe that's where it's going to come, that we're going to get that big leap where suddenly he's going to jump to the top of the league in deflections and steals. I think that's possible. And that's really what kind of fantasy player we're looking at here. Probably more limited offensively, potential for some big offensive stats, and maybe some upside that he could eventually become a guy who does play a little bit on ball as a wing. That toolkit, that starter kit for that on-ball wing is there, and there's some flashes of it. So that makes me have him inside my top 100 in Dynasty, just kind of inside there in the 90 range. That's where I've had him for a while, because there is that high upside outcome.
Yeah, and he hasn't turned 20 yet, so obviously still a ton of upside. I was watching just like his shot attempts on NBA.com, and watching the beginning of the season, what he was like, the shot attempts that he had versus the end of the season, you could see the growth, which obviously like you expect out of a rookie between his first few NBA games and his last few of his rookie season. But cool to see that development. Kind of excited to see what else. And that wasn't supposed to be any sort of pun intended with the cool development, but. The rest of the Wizards team is not nearly as exciting to me outside of their rookie. But we can still, hit on them quickly. Jordan Poole went 86th in our mock draft. Not that I just thought this, but the numbers kind of backed it up. He was better when Tyus Jones wasn't on the floor, especially late in the season. But in 14 games without Tyus Jones this year, 21.2 points, 7.1 assists, 3.4 rebounds per game. Are you excited about him at all moving into, because obviously he had a ton of hype heading into this season and then it was abysmal. Are you buying back in at all after a pretty solid stretch to close the year?
Yeah, I mean, he's top 40-ish in categories leagues during the final couple months of the season. But, I mean, we've seen the story with Poole. We said it a year ago on this podcast. The one consistent thing with Jordan Poole is inconsistency. That's been true since he was at Michigan. You never knew which player you were going to get game to game, season to season with him. And I think that'll continue to be true. His role will stay large because he's not going to be able to get moved off of this roster. I think he'll be better next season than he was this year. I mean, the beginning stretch of the season was some of the worst basketball that we saw in the NBA this year, especially in the volume that was involved. He just looked like a player who completely lost his confidence. And this is a player who entirely runs on confidence. That's who he is. That's who he was in college. Extremely confident player. And he looked like that was zapped from him at the beginning of the season. So I think it will get better for Poole. I want to be clear about something that I said earlier. I don't see Tyus Jones, Jordan Poole, Kyle Kuzma as next part of the next great Wizards team. I will say that Denny Avdija can be. And I think what we saw from Denny Avdija down the stretch this season is going to get lost because no one was watching the Wizards. No one was paying attention. Denny Avdija turned himself into a legitimately good NBA starter this season. One of the better defensive wings in the entire league. And his ability to be able to drive to the basket and finish at the rim is extremely impressive. He's a powerful wing player. And the three-point shooting improved this year, even if the volume hasn't still come up to the level that we want. Avdija has also been a plus passer as a power forward for a long time. He can defend up and down in the lineup. He is now on a high-value bargain contract, and maybe the Wizards are just going to parlay that into trading him because he would be extremely valuable to a contender for all the defensive versatility and the way that he can fit in as a lower usage player on offense. But I loved what we saw from Avdija this season after we saw flashes of it last year as well. It was more consistent this year. He's somebody that I've moved up into the top 75 of my dynasty rankings because of all the indicators of him being able to be a consistent big minute player, given how much he can impact quality winning basketball, even while stuck on the Wizards.
And that was actually going to be my next question is this the Denny Avdija that's here to stay? Like, because he was much better overall this season, but especially down the stretch late, just before the All-Star break, he had 24 and 11, 21 and 13, 25 and 7, and then 43 and 15 with six threes. And then even, you know, last few games of the season, he had 24, 12 and 8 against Chicago. He had 32 at 10 and 5 against Toronto, 22 and 12, 23 and 8, like a lot of really good rebounding and scoring numbers. But I guess you kind of already mentioned it, that he took a leap forward this year, and he is a guy that is going to be very good. He went 101 in our dynasty mock draft. So I guess a guy that is moving up, you said you had him top 75.
Yeah, I'm right inside of the top 75. And the reason is that this isn't a case where all of a sudden there's some outlier jump in statistics based on it being tanking season. It's building off of the things that he already did extremely well. And he had already done well in prior seasons, just kind of further development of that as he's playing in his fourth season in the NBA and only 23 years old. This is where players do hit their prime and all of a sudden hit another level. And that slow progression for Avdija and building on the things that he developed through those first four seasons is why I think this is sustainable and real. Now, no, he's not going to be a high usage player, but he wasn't this year either. He was below 20% usage on the entire season. His fantasy value is not going to be come from scoring 25 points a game. That's not who he's going to be. But what he can do is be a really high level rebounder for his position. I think he can get better defensive stats than what we saw this season. I think some of that increased offensive role reduced some of the output that he was able to put out as an off ball defender this season, but 65.4% at the rim, and he drives to the rim relentlessly, getting about 10 drives per game on a per 75 basis. That having that ability offensively to be able to attack the rim consistently and apply that rim pressure, finish at the rim, that gives him an offensive role, especially when you're shooting 37.6% from three this season on volume that is at least middling, and I think can still grow from there. But it's enough to be able to have to defend him, and at that point you're getting that ability to drive becomes even more valuable if teams have to come out to be able to defend that three. That's why we're seeing the growth from him. I really like him. I think it's lost in a lost Wizards season, but he's definitely a player I'd be targeting this offseason because I don't think people value him and view him as a guy who can contribute in fantasy long-term the way that I believe he can.
He's a guy that I was starting to be out on a little bit before this season, but when we were expecting Jordan Poole to have a big year as kind of the, I guess, given the ultimate green light on a crappy team, it was Avdija that ended up taking a leap forward. But one other guy, because I have on this slide, key pieces, Kyle Kuzma on the list. I don't really want to talk about Kyle Kuzma because we kind of know what he is at this point. Marvin Bagley is a guy I want to talk about who in this mock draft we're doing, we are almost 200 picks in and he still hasn't been picked yet. But after the trade, he averaged 13.3 points, 8.1 rebounds, shot 58.1% from the field. Is he a guy that, how much value does that or does he hold for you, especially if Washington doesn't take a center and he continues to start heading into next season?
Yeah, so Bagley gave Detroit good minutes as a rotation big before he got Monty Williams pulled him out of the rotation. And I think he was pretty solid for Washington in the limited amount of time that we saw him. I think he's a rotation big. I don't think that you can start him. I don't think he's going to get those kinds of minutes. I think he's going to be a guy who's going to be around 18, 20 minutes a game, depending on the team that he's on. That will probably be his role next year, as I'd imagine that the Wizards are going to fill in their big rotation. So I don't see fantasy upside there. I think he's a guy who can help you in field goal percentage and rebounds, and that's about it. There's not a whole lot else to his fantasy game, and not a lot of him that's interesting. The guy in the big rotation in Washington that's interesting to me is a guy who came over in March, and that's Tristan Vukcevic, who played for Partizan for most of the season, was drafted in the second round by the Wizards, came in the middle of March. We only got a handful of games from him, but he's really interesting because if you look at what he did overseas in Partizan this year, he was playing 14 minutes a night across 30 games. He shoots 43.2% from three, 83.9% of the line. He does that at 6'10". So right away, that's interesting from an NBA perspective. Bringing spacing at 6'10", solid rebounder, some rim protection ability. The real question for him now, he signs a two-year contract. One of those years was already this year that just expired. For next year, it's a club option. They have a deadline to be able to decide whether they're going to exercise that club option at the end of June. That could get pushed out a little bit. That happens all the time. But it's possible that Vukcevic isn't even going to be in the NBA next year. Maybe the Wizards will pick it up. They don't have a whole lot else going on for them. Maybe they'll see what they get through the draft and push that deadline out. But my thought with him is that it's at least an interesting stash because of how little is in this front court rotation for the Wizards. This is a guy who potentially could be a stretch five and give some interesting things to a Wizards lineup that really has nothing out there. Rashawn Holmes is likely to be back given his guaranteed money on his deal. You have Bagley, but there's nothing really to hang your hat on here, and it could be a way for them to test that out. I don't know if he can defend in the NBA. The all-in-one metrics were at least intrigued with what he did defensively and didn't hate it, but it's too small of a sample to be able to say at this point. And I think from what we saw in Summer League, there could be some movement issues there, but this is a deep sleeper that I'm at least interested in on a team that really lacks deep sleepers and interest at this point.
Yeah, and he finally kind of saw legit minutes final five games that he appeared in, because I think he ended up missing two of the last three. Scored in double figures in five straight, so there's upside there. The shooting was obviously like not quite that 43% from three, but still able to hit some, had a game with three blocks. So yeah, plenty of upside. As far as Washington in the draft, I think they could basically, I mean, they have to go best player available. There's no, oh, well, we kind of like these few players on our roster, let's try and fill this out, which when you win 15 games, you should go best player available. So really you can kind of go down the list of the top eight prospects or so and say, yeah, no, that would probably work in Washington. They'd probably start year one. Is there anybody in particular that you either really want to see in Washington or you just think would be a good fit for them?
This team needs shot creation and playmaking desperately. They need someone to be able to be an on-ball creator for them. My favorite player in that regard in this class is easily Nikola Topic. I think that would be a dream fit. I ran a mock draft earlier this week that I put out into social media and on my Patreon. And that's what I mocked to the Wizards to get Nikola Topic. I think it'd be a great fit. Plus-sized playmaker. He's an excellent pick-and-roll operator. And while his three-point percentage hasn't been great this season, the volume is strong, and he's hit threes previously, and he's a really strong free throw shooter, which has a larger sample and usually is a stronger indicator than three-point percentage of what a player's NBA three-point percentage is going to be. So I believe in him as at least a solid shooter in the long term, and I just love his ability to be able to get to the rim and finish. It's really strong for a player who is playing against grown men overseas and excelling earlier this year for Mega. And he's moved up into a higher level club with Red Star. Had his first game back this week that he had played since January. So we're going to get to see a little bit of him because that season stretches out a little bit more. I could easily see him getting some momentum back in him as a prospect. And he could be a guy who could go number one. He's been near the top of my board or at number one all through the pre-draft process so far.
Yeah, number of guys will be in, I guess, consideration for that top pick because, like I said right at the beginning, there is no Wemby in this draft. There is a million, not a million, but like a lot of different players that could end up going first, and it's going to be a pretty random order depending on whose mock draft you looked at. But we'll move on to our third and final team, Portland, who, when I originally kind of made my list of the teams I was going to go in order, they were tied for third with Charlotte. They had that tiebreaker this, I guess, 2 days ago, or maybe it was yesterday. So they finished with the quote-unquote fourth worst record. Charlotte got the tiebreaker. So this isn't the bottom three teams. It's 1, 2, and 4. But they have a 13.2% chance at the first pick. And then they have a 50% chance to land in the top four. Worst they can pick is eighth. Right now, their projected picks are fourth, but obviously that depends on the lottery. They have Golden State's pick, which is currently projected to go 14th. That is top, I think, four protected. So if that pick leaps up into the top four, I believe Golden State will get that. Portland won't. And then they have 33 and 40. They are rebuilding with a franchise player in Scoot Henderson and franchise players in a number of other young guys and just solid pieces. Like, this team, I think, is more talented than their record shows. They obviously had a number of injuries, like Anthony Simons got hurt game one. And then they had the quote unquote injuries down the stretch where Jeremy Grant was doubtful for like the final 17 games of the season or something ridiculous like that and didn't end up playing at all. Matt, what are your overall thoughts on this Portland team?
I think Scoot Henderson and Shaedon Sharpe are the building blocks of this team going forward. Despite this being a tough season for both of them in different ways, I believe in both of them long-term as prospects of the one and the two on this roster. And then beyond that, I don't think that there's anything that's at least a core part of what'll be the next good Blazers team. That means that they have a lot of flexibility going forward and a lot of opportunities to make trades to be able to build a stronger core going forward. But I think everything needs to be built around the idea that they have their backcourt established with two highly athletic and explosive players in Scoot Henderson and Shaedon Sharpe.
And with Scoot, he went 31 in our mock draft. The final month of the season, he averaged 19.2 points, 8.1 assists, 1.4 steals, 2.4 threes, and shot 42.1% from the floor, which was good considering how he shot most of the season. Do you think that late stretch that we kind of saw from him just was him turning a corner, kind of figuring out the NBA game? And should we have high expectations for him heading into his second season?
Yeah, this is where the advantage of being now kind of an old head in the fantasy analysis game helps me, because this happens over and over and over again, and yet it fools people time and time again. Young perimeter guard prospects almost always struggle in their rookie season. It happens over and over. I think Trae Young is like one of the only examples where that didn't happen. And honestly, he was dreadful in summer league. People thought that he was going to be an absolute bust after that.
The first 2 months were not good for him either. They was second half of the season where he really took off.
Exactly. So it is extremely rare for on-ball guards, perimeter players, to have strong rookie seasons. Whether you're looking back more recently to Darius Garland and De'Aaron Fox, who struggled mightily, very similar to Scoot Henderson in their rookie seasons. You can go further back. James Harden, Steve Nash, Kobe Bryant, Tony Parker, Gary Payton, John Stockton. I mean, like, we've got Hall of Famers, Pantheon-level players who looked awful as rookies, because it's really hard and it's a huge learning curve to be an on-ball creator as a rookie. So Scoot showed us at the end of the season what it's going to look like long term. The assist numbers were massive once he was given the opportunity to be able to do it. He's a really, really good point guard. And we saw the three-point shooting tick up pretty significantly. We already knew that he was going to be an awesome downhill driver. He was averaging 14.2 drives per 75 as a rookie. That's only going to go up from there. He's going to be one of the best driving guards in the NBA. And once he finishes at the rim, which with his wingspan, his strength, he's going to end up developing the craft to be able to score at the rim, just like all these guards end up doing who have his talent level. He's going to be really good. So I haven't wavered on Scoot. I think there's probably some degree of panic about him in the fantasy community, in the dynasty community. You should be checking in, trying to get him at a discount after a bit of a difficult rookie season. This is a tale as old as time in the NBA and a perfect opportunity to acquire him.
Yeah, I was expecting him to, I guess, figure it out a little slightly earlier than he did. And I honestly, all season long, kept referencing Trae Young figuring it out in the second half of the season, because that's the rookie point guard that I watched the most, because I remember watching him get drafted, suck in summer league, and then get better over those rookie year. It was more like the last 2 or 3 weeks that he really started to figure it out. hoping that that's, you know, that is something that he can just bring in to start next season. But if it isn't flawless right at the beginning, still hopeful for him long term. I had him 23 in my most recent dynasty rankings, which were post trade deadline. I don't think I may drop him a few spots from that, but still very, very high on him. DeAndre Ayton went 67th in that mock draft. And this was a quote from him. I don't know exactly when he said this, but what I showed you guys the second half of the season is what I've been trying to show my whole career. He was averaging 22.7 points, 12.5 rebounds, and shot 58.3% from the floor after the All-Star break. Do you believe that this is something he can continue to show, or was this, hey, everybody else that usually shoots the ball was hurt, so I guess fine, we'll give DeAndre Ayton shots, and it looked good?
Yeah, DeAndre Ayton is good at what he's good at, and he can hit a mid-range jumper. He can score fairly efficiently at the rim. He can rebound the hell out of the basketball. Other than that, DeAndre Ayton has gotten significantly worse as a defensive player over the last three seasons. We have fallen a long way since the Suns' finals run. The allergy that he has to finishing through contact or even taking contact in the interior is downright embarrassing. His free throw rate was historically low this season. That's who he is. He's someone who would rather hang around in the mid-range and be able to pad stats in points and rebounds the way that he did at the end of the season than actually contribute to winning basketball. I think he's going to be stuck on this Blazers roster over the next couple of seasons. You're going to get good fantasy production during that time, like you did in the second half of this season. And after that, I think there's a good chance that he's going to struggle, kind of similar to an Andre Drummond, struggle to be able to find a consistent starting role in the NBA just because you're getting so little that leads to winning basketball from DeAndre Ayton. So I think enjoy the production, but sell high on it. I want people to be thinking of their exit strategy if they roster DeAndre Ayton on their dynasty team, because I don't think these minutes and this role is going to continue going forward given what kind of player he has shown himself to be and is comfortable being.
And where do you have him ranked?
I have him at 81st right now, which is significantly lower than a lot of dynasty rankings, because while you're going to get that short-term production, it might be top 50 production like it was this year, I don't think that's going to be sustainable long-term. So I enjoy that top 50 production, but I'm lower than him than top 50, even though he's still in his prime, because I think that there could be a significant fall off in his later 20s.
Yeah, very fair. You mentioned Shaedon Sharpe as a guy that should be considered a building block for Portland. It should be him and Scoot. As far as fantasy, because I really do think he's going to be a good NBA player. As far as fantasy, he was 187th, according to Basketball Monster and Ninecat, 15.9 points, 5 rebounds, 2.9 assists, 0.9 steals, 1.9 threes, 40.6% from the floor. Is, I guess, kind of a similar conversation to what we had with Jaden Ivey, just looking at the regular, just Ninecat value, except his free throws are a little bit better. Where is his fantasy production coming from? Is it just points and threes, or are there other categories that you think he can make a pretty good impact with?
Yeah, this is where looking at the underlying metrics, the underlying stats is really important, because with on-ball guards and wings, when they're teenagers, it's really hard to see the outlines of what their future stat set is going to be, because it makes such significant leaps over time. And it's usually pretty ugly early on. With Sharp, there was a lot of growth here, even though we saw him go down in mid-January and then didn't see him come back. I don't think people realize how much better he got in some ways this season. His assist rate nearly doubled. His free throw shooting and foul drawing made a huge leap. He went up to 82.4% at the line. For a guy who has a very smooth three-point shot, to be able to see the free throw shooting also make that leap, I think there's room for even more growth there. And he got up to a 79th percentile free throw rate. If you can have his athleticism and you can have that kind of foul rate, that's star indication. That's your ability to be able to get advantage over other players, draw fouls, and he drove to the rim so much more consistently. His shot creation takes a huge leap up to 78th percentile on unassisted shot attempts, and he nearly doubled his drives per 70 35 possessions. So this was the beginnings of the breakout. It was lost in a lost season, but I could easily see Sharp making a huge leap in his third season based on all of those indicators that we just saw, which are so similar to similar players who broke out in their third and fourth seasons, showing those same things early on in their careers. This was a leap, even if it wasn't a leap in fantasy. And this is another player that I have as a big target in the offseason, because I think he's going to have that big leap in the next couple seasons that's going to put him into being a star scoring wing in the NBA.
Yeah, tons of upside. I know he was kind of a question mark coming into the draft a little bit because he didn't play in college, but was the number one high school player in his class, if I'm not mistaken. So it's going to take time, but got a ton of upside. It's going to be really good, in my opinion. The last guy to talk about for Portland, Anfernee Simons, who went 62nd in our Dynasty mock draft. How much better do you think he can get? Because obviously the points, the threes, the assists, the free throw percentage, all really good this year. And the other five categories, he was either bad or didn't make an impact. He's about to turn 25, so like kind of getting towards his prime. Do you think he can get better in some of those categories, or do you think he can kind of get better in some of the categories that he's not strong in to at least be kind of into enough where, because I think he was 93rd in NICAT leagues per Basketball Monster. Do you think he can be a top 75 or a top 50 player, or is this just kind of the numbers that he has shown, like that's just who he is?
Yeah, so this is a player where I diverge pretty greatly from kind of the public consensus. Hashtag basketball has crowdsourced dynasty rankings that actually I think are really informative and interesting. They have almost 100,000 votes to be able to develop rankings based on how the public views players, which is fantastic. I use it all the time as a reference. And if you haven't already, go vote on there. You can spend 10, 15 minutes longer. I won't admit how long I've spent just clicking, voting between two players of which one that you like more for a dynasty league. And the more we do it, the better it's going to get. So everyone should do their public service and do it. The public has him at number 55. And I get it. He's 25 years old. Really big role this year. Really good shooter. I think that Anfernee Simons is a really good offensive player. The problem is I might have just had the high watermark for what his entire career is going to be fantasy-wise, because he's not likely to have a larger role than what he just had this season. Even next year, if he stays in Portland, it's unlikely that his role is going to be as large as it was, that he's going to have as much usage, that he's going to have this much of an on-ball role, given that you have Scoot Henderson and Shaedon Sharpe looming in the background. And on top of that, I think there's a good chance that he could get moved, given that he's got a couple more years under contract at a fairly reasonable number, around $25 million. He could be a great addition for somewhere like Orlando, which could desperately needs his shooting and offensive ability. And they could cover up for his defensive deficiencies. And deficient they are, because this is one of the worst defensive players in the entire NBA. I don't think that there's any way that it can work to be able to have Scoot Henderson, Shaedon Sharpe, and Anfernee Simons as a long-term trio. I don't think that's going to be able to be what the Blazers can do. I think they should get off of Simons. I think they should move him this offseason. Clear opportunity for the future of their team. And they could probably get something pretty valuable back in return for him from a team like Orlando that has a lot of assets, because it's been in this taking territory for a few years prior to this. So that's what I would say. And that's why I would move off of him. That's why I'm lower on him than the consensus. I don't think that the role is going to get larger. And I think the fantasy game is too deficient. There's just too many categories where he gives you almost nothing out of it. That's not going to improve. You're not going to start getting defensive stats from Anfernee Simons. You're not going to get rebounding. You're not going to get strong field goal percentage. He is what he is. I think he's a good player, but I don't think that that's someone that you should be investing in and thinking that there's going to be growth from this point going forward.
If he were to get traded to a team like an Orlando, because I'm just looking at it, they shot, just below 25% from three in through their first two games of this series. Shooting has been an issue for them all season. Adding a guy like Simons, I think, would help that. Do you think that what he did this season, I mean, I would assume the volume is different playing alongside Paolo Banchero and Franz Wagner, but is it something he can replicate for a few years? Or do you think, I mean, whether it's playing alongside Scoot, playing in Orlando or playing somewhere else, that the numbers are going to kind of drop off from this year?
Yeah, he's not going to have nearly 30% usage. He's not going to on Orlando. He's not going to have the on-ball role where he's going to be playmaking to the degree he was in Portland this year. If he's on that team, a lot of that's going to be going through Paolo and Franz, I think that there would be a dramatic shift, and it might look a little bit more like what it looked like when you had a CJ McCollum and a Damian Lillard in Portland, and Simons was coming up, where you know he's got more of an off-ball role, and he can thrive in that. He can knock down threes, and I think that's exactly what any team that's acquiring him is going to be looking to get from him, rather than having him be the primary creator of offense on the team.
Yeah, and just looking at the draft now, I think in contrast to the first two teams we talked about, Portland does have more of a, I guess, a core few players. With you have Scoot, you have Shaedon Sharpe, you have Ayton, Jeremy Grant, Anthony Simons, like these pieces here that are good NBA players. A couple of other young guys like Tumani Kamara, Chris Murray. Obviously Chris Murray isn't impacting who you take with, the third overall or fourth overall pick in the draft. But is there anybody in particular that you think would fit really well with what Portland has?
Yeah, I think they need to be able to fill out the wing, especially if they can get potential defensive anchors on the wing. I think a Stephon Castle would be an awesome fit to be able to put out there. There'd be a super athletic group with Scoot and Shaedon and him. Ron Holland could be a good fit there. Modest Bozelis, Cody Williams. If they're falling back as they potentially could they could fall back even to like seventh in the draft. A lot of those players are going to be in consideration for them, and I think that's something that we could see where they're targeting those wings to be able to find a long-term fit alongside Scoot and Shaedon. Because they have Ayton stuck at center, maybe that's not going to be a destination for a Donovan Clingan, but like I was just talking about, there's no reason that you're building around DeAndre Ayton, so even that could be a possibility. I'm open to just about anything with this team that adds talent, because there's not a whole lot other than Sharpe and Henderson that I think is a long-term building block in their starting lineup. Guys like Tumani Kamara and Jabari Walker, Chris Murray, there's interesting things for the rotation, especially with Kamara. I think Kamara could even be a 3-and-D starter if he develops his three-point shot enough, but there's just not anything to be able to say for certain, okay, these guys are going to be starters along with Sharpe and Henderson.
Yeah, and that'll do it for us talking about Portland, but I do want to talk about some of your dynasty rankings versus this industry mock draft, which I've kind of compared a little bit, and I made it very dramatic by calling it Matt versus the industry. But just comparing some of your rankings to where players went, and not necessarily that, these were significantly different, but just kind of interesting to me and players that I wanted to talk about. So the first one was LaMelo Ball, who you have ranked 16th. This mock draft, I told you, I didn't mention LaMelo earlier. He went 14th. He's a guy, I think, at the beginning of, like, if we're doing this last year, he was a player I want to say I had going fourth or fifth, but probably a consensus top six or seven. And then the year before that, probably like a consensus top three guy. So the injuries have obviously taken away from him a lot. Is that why he's dropped for you, or is there another reason?
No, it's 100% about whether LaMelo Ball is going to do what Steph Curry and Trae Young have done and wear custom fitted ankle braces while he's playing or not. And that sounds kind of silly, but he came into the season saying that he was going to wear ankle braces after having a consistent record of ankle injuries. That's what Steph Curry did to be able to turn around his career. That's what Trae Young does to be able to protect his ankles. A lot of players do it. He did not do that. He scrapped that almost immediately. And lo and behold, surprise, surprise, he ended up with another ankle injury and tendinopathy in that surgically repaired right ankle. We are getting to a point now where further injuries to those ankles is going to cause significant long-term maintenance and perhaps impact his career going forward. That's where we're at. So that risk lowers the potential floor for what we could see for LaMelo Ball for the rest of his career, because I love the player and I think he's an awesome fantasy player. I think when he plays and when he does get back on the court, he's going to be great. But if he's not going to wear the ankle braces, and again, he's saying now, he just had an interview this last week with the Charlotte Observer where he said that he was going to, but that's what he said last year, and then he didn't. And he didn't feel comfortable wearing them. And if that's where it's going to be, if he's going to continue to do it, his career could end up going like his brother's very quickly. That's the concern here. And I had LaMelo Ball in the top three of my dynasty rankings a couple of years ago. I loved him coming off of that season where he played almost every game. But these last two seasons have shown us that if he's not going to take the health of his ankles seriously and do what he needs to do to be able to protect them, his NBA career is not going to go the way that it should.
So if he were to say, whether he wears ankle braces or not, hopefully he does, but if he were able to play 70, 75 games this year, or even like 65, and produce, you know, to the level he has or has shown that he's taken a step forward, how high do you think he would be able to go in your dynasty rankings?
Yeah, I mean, he could be up there with Tyrese Halliburton, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, you know, in the conversation with people like, you know, Luka Doncic and Nikola Jokic. I mean, that's the potential. We've already seen him reach first round level production for big stretches in his NBA career. That's the kind of fantasy player that he is. You can get big, you know, very strong points, huge assists, steals, legally near the top of the league, just like sub Steph Curry three pointers. That's where we can be with LaMelo Ball at his best. I need to see him make that commitment. And as silly as it sounds, it really just comes down to whether he's going to wear the braces or not. That doesn't guarantee that he's not going to have an ankle injury again, but we've seen it work for players like Steph Curry, who had exactly the same issue of recurrent injuries to their ankles. And it's something that he needs to do. And that's where I buy into more of the, does LaMelo Ball take things seriously? I think he's a good kid. I think his teammates love him. His coaches have loved his work ethic. I think he gets a bad rap in a lot of ways. But this is an area where he needs to have the maturity to be able to say, I might not be comfortable with this. This might change some things for me. I don't know if it's how it looks, how it feels to him. But even if he comes into opening night with them on, I want to see him consistently do it, because he scrapped it last year and it's costing him already. He got his big contract, but if he wants to be able to be the NBA player that he could be, we need to see that commitment from him.
Moving on to Jalen Johnson, you had him ranked 29th. He went 24th in this mock draft. My last dynasty rankings, I had him 32nd. I guess the question is now, how high is too high for Jalen Johnson? Because he truly, had he played 65 games, I think he would have definitely been in consideration for the Most Improved Player of the Year award. How high is too high to rank him at this point?
I have him at number 29, and I am constantly worried that I'm not high enough on him, and here's why. He did, at age 21 season, a top 50 producer in fantasy, and he did that with sub 20% usage. So there's the easy low-hanging fruit for a guy who, coming up as a prospect, one of the top prospects in his class here, looked like a point forward. If that usage comes back up, and it comes up into a range where we're talking mid-20s, where he has more of an on-ball role, where he's able to play make a little bit more, with the three-point progression that we saw this year, the volume continues to increase, continues to hit threes. If that's where we're headed with this, then he could have top 10 seasons coming up. Because the stat set is that good, that he could be sub 20% usage and still to be able to be a top 50 producer. That tells me that the ceiling is even higher than where we have it right now, than what we're thinking it could be. So for me, I think I'm being conservative having him inside of the top 30 right now. There's part of me that says there's a realistic upside here of this guy reaching into first round value at some point in his career, because of everything that we've seen that doesn't involve a heavy on-ball role. What if that's the next step in Atlanta? Then we could really see things take off in a direction that puts them up where Scotty Barnes was this year. That's what we could be looking at, where Scotty Barnes is holding first-round value at points this season. That's where Jalen Johnson could go. So I see that as realistic, and that makes me constantly look at my rankings and say, should I go even higher?
Yeah, I mentioned I had him at 32, and I think with Hawks players, I just try and make sure, okay, Noah, make sure you're not being biased here. Make sure, and now I feel like I'm not being biased enough, because everybody has him around ahead of where I had him. And if they trade one of DeJounte or Trae Young this summer, like rumors suggest they will, then we could see even more usage out of Jalen Johnson, more on-ball creation out of him. And yeah, I mean, would be fun to see him hopping up into the top 10. So. Brandon Miller, as a rookie, or just came off a really strong rookie season. You had him 35th. He went 38th in this mock. After you mentioned hashtag basketball's community dynasty rankings, I went and looked. They have him at 31st, or I guess the community has him 31st. How good can he be? Because I don't know if you felt similar about this, or if it's just me and I need to get over it. But after they took him at 2 over Scoot Henderson, I was like, that's just such a dumb pick. Like, pick Scoot. Not only has he proven me wrong, but I think I had like kind of a bad taste in my mouth because I just wanted to be so right about Scoot, and he wasn't playing well, that I feel like I was harder in my mind on Brandon Miller than I should have been. And he, like, kind of the second half of the season, I was like, wow, like, this kid is so good. Like, they made a good pick. How do you feel about Brandon Miller? How good can he be?
Yeah, let's put a marker down right now. Before we get to Summer League later this year, everybody remember how bad Brandon Miller was in Summer League and how little that mattered once he actually got into his rookie season. I will say I was also one of those people who's a Scoot over Brandon Miller person just because I thought the upside was higher. I did like Brandon Miller as a prospect. I had him in the same tier as the Thompson Twins in my rookie rankings. I thought that he was going to be a really good fantasy player. I had my expectations surpassed for Miller this year because of how good his shooting was for a rookie. We're talking about 39.2% on a bunch of catch and shoot threes, 37.3% on above the break threes at high volume, top 50 performer in the last month of the season. And yeah, that's silly season. But the fact that he's able to produce at that kind of fantasy level is not something that people thought we were going to get from Brandon Miller. I think there was kind of an idea that maybe he could end up being a good NBA wing, but the fantasy game was going to lag behind it. But he was top 80-ish in the second half of the season as a whole. So it wasn't just the silly season. It wasn't just the full tanking season for Charlotte. Huge three-point volume. He gets to his spots in the mid-range with ease, which he did in high school, but then kind of took away when Alabama didn't shoot any mid-rangers. He got back to that this year. That's going to be a huge part of his game. And I think the steals will improve with time. That's not really there for him right now, but the minutes are going to be huge, and he's going to improve his feel as an off-ball defender with time. He's got good size for it. I really like Brandon Miller. I think he's going to live in that range where maybe he peaks as a top 25 player at his very best, because I think he could be near the top of the league in scoring and three-point volume, be solid in other categories. I think he's going to be really good for a long time. I have him ranked in my rankings right now at number 35. So this is a long-term asset, one of the top players on your dynasty team that you can build around for years into the future. And there was so much that looked sustainable to be able to be an all-star NBA wing that we saw in this rookie season.
Moving on to Cam Whitmore, you have him ranked 78th. He fell to 106 in this mock. And actually, as I'm saying this, let me see if I can see where he is on. He went, okay, so he's 52nd. That's very high in this, in hashtag basketball's keeper consensus dynasty rankings. I was going to ask why you were very high on him in comparison to this mock, but it seems like the rest of the community has him even higher. Where do you kind of see, or where do you see him kind of projecting and or playing? Oh my gosh, I'm fumbling over my words. Who do you think Cam Whitmore can be?
Well, let's look at it this way. Cam Whitmore was kind of viewed as a likely top five pick before his precipitous fall in the draft last year. That was, from the best we can tell, caused by some questions about maybe his longevity and health as an NBA player, and also maybe his character or attitude as a basketball player. Let's be clear. If they ran a redraft right now, he would not be falling out of the lottery. He'd be going significantly higher. I think this is a player who, what we saw this season was a huge leap forward in what he is as a shooter. This is a guy who at age 19 goes from shooting only 34% from three at Villanova on mediocre volume to 39% on 10 attempts per game in the G League, carries that over to the NBA with elite three-point shooting volume, and still hit 36%. So we've got a big sample size now of this guy being a legitimate high-volume three-point shooter. That was not even part of the profile that we saw for him pre-draft. And that's now there now. I think that's pretty well established given the amount of games and attempts that we're talking about across the G League and the NBA. Shooting at high volume, high efficiency with confidence. If he can do that with his athleticism, his vertical explosion, his ability to be able to blow by with the size and frame that he has, this is a long-term NBA starting wing who you can play alongside anybody because he's a good off-ball player. He's got the athleticism to be able to cut, showed that really well for the Rockets this year. He can get out and transition and dunk on anyone. This team is going to be able to play up-tempo like it did after the break, even before Şengün got hurt. You saw that transition, a game step up significantly, the pace step up significantly. That is how the Rockets are going to want to play because of all the athleticism that they put on the court. And he gets to the rim at will. This is the starter kit for a star NBA wing. It is everything that you were looking for a wing who is going to be near the top of the league in scoring. He doesn't know what he's doing on defense yet, but he competes and he has the body for it. He's going to get there, and Ime Udoka is going to get him there as well. I think his potential was masked a little bit for some, now obviously not everybody, because he's ranked number 52 in the crowdsourced rankings, but I think some, because the minutes weren't entirely there, that he didn't play in the NBA through the beginning portion of the season. People might not have been paying the most attention to the Rockets during the parts where Cam Whitmore was playing the most and best. This is every bit of the prospect that we thought he was pre-draft and more. And now we know that the Rockets got the steal of the draft. I think they know it too. And this is a player that you should be looking to acquire if somebody in your league, like in the mock that ran, that where he got outside of the top 100, that could be your league. And if it is, you should be getting him, because I think Cam Whitmore is going to be has the potential to be an all-star level wing in the NBA because of his athleticism and because of the precocious scoring ability that we saw this season.
And one last player to ask about. You have Walker Kessler ranked 95th. He went 88th in this mock draft. I think if you were looking at, I don't know exactly where you've had him ranked, but I know in either mock drafts or other rankings, other leagues, he was significantly higher than barely inside the top 100 this time last year, coming off an excellent rookie season. Now, obviously, he didn't see as many minutes as we wanted out of him. He wasn't a consistent starter the way that probably most people thought he should have been. What is it, just a matter of, hey, let's, like Will Hardy, put him back in the starting lineup. Let's see what the numbers do. Like, they go back up, boom, great. His dynasty ranking goes up. Is that what it takes, or is there something else that you think we need to see out of him to have him go back up?
I think that what we saw from Walker Kessler, Chet Holmgren, and Victor Wembanyama is really instructive for where the NBA is now and is going forward. All of those guys were near the top of the league in block percentage. Really strong, young rim protectors. But there's a reason that Walker Kessler played far fewer minutes than Chet Holmgren or Victor Wembanyama. And it's because he does not contribute offensively or in holistically on defense to what they provide in the modern NBA game. Kessler is a more traditional big center. A big-bodied center doesn't move terribly well laterally. He's fine, but that's not his strength the way that it is with Victor or Chet. And offensively, he doesn't operate as a hub. He's not a shooter from three the way that Chet and Wemby are. And I get that's an unfair comparison. But when you look at what they do contribute, what one of their strengths are, they all have the strength of being able to block shots, protect the rim, and they can do it at an elite level. But what Walker is missing is what holds back players like Jakob Poeltl, Ivica Zubac, Jonas Valanciunas, big-bodied centers who don't contribute enough offensively and also don't have the full holistic defensive ability to warrant big minutes out on the court. Maybe that can change for Walker Kessler. I haven't seen it. I think he's probably going to be more like a Zubac, more like a Poeltl, more like a Valanciunas, where their game is going to be a little bit more, the minutes are going to be limited by their limitations. And if it's not happening on a Utah team that isn't very good this past year, I don't necessarily see that changing in the future for him. With that said, the block rate is so high, the finishing at the rim, the rebounding. If he's only playing 25 to 27 minutes a night, you still have a really strong fantasy relevant player. I just think we got a little bit of ahead of ourselves, and I was lower on him than some. Some got him up very high into dynasty rankings based on a really good rookie season. I don't think that upside to be that kind of like perennial top 50 player that people were hoping for, depending on how you're looking at 9-cat rankings, even higher than that. I don't think that's there because of what the NBA game is for big men in 2024 and beyond.
And really quickly, before I let you go, I did want to bring this up because I saw your tweet the other day and about using per 100 possessions instead of just per game or per 36 stats, because you mentioned G League Ignite average 100 possessions per game this season, UConn average 68. Obviously, that's a big difference with pace. I have a little like model that I use or that I've been working on that uses per 100 possessions or just like block percentage, like percentages, to compare like rookie prospects. So I think seeing per 100 possessions was something I saw for the first time like a few years ago from Andy Bailey, who writes for Bleacher Report. Is that something that like the per 100 possessions, is that something you've been using for a while, or I guess maybe even per 75? I know you've referenced per 75 a few times. And I guess, can you talk a little bit about what the difference is like actually showing?
Yeah. So when you're talking about statistics and trying to compare players, especially across leagues, but even within the same league, every team plays with a different pace. So 1 minute of basketball for even in the NBA, the Indiana Pacers, is completely different than it might be for some of these slower paced teams in the NBA. And that makes it a more stat rich environment. There's more possessions in a minute of basketball when the Pacers are playing. So there's more opportunities as the ball is changing, going back and forth, for more shots, more steals, more rebounds, everything. And that's what you see in the G League, where the pace, everybody hovers around 100 possessions per game, versus college basketball, where not only do you have a shorter game, you've got a game that's played at a much slower pace. So when you're just looking at per game statistics, someone like Ron Holland's per game statistics look better than a lot of the prospects who are coming out of college. You then contextualize it into per possession stats, and suddenly you level that playing field and realize, oh, wait, no, this is completely the opposite of what I thought. And I saw somebody on Twitter do this the other day, where they put up Ron Holland stats in the G League against what Cam Whitmore did last year at Villanova. And I thought this was such a great example, because Villanova played about 65 possessions per game the prior year. So it's very similar to what we're seeing with UConn. And of course, you know, Cam Whitmore's stats in that environment, and he also didn't play the minutes last year at Villanova that Holland played for G League Ignite this year. So there was a lot of reasons why this comparison was off. But on top of that, if you look at what Cam Whitmore did as a 19-year-old this year in the G League, it was dominant in that stat environment. And he was playing at about the same age and the same, and in the same league in the same year as Ron Holland. You could make that comparison directly. And this is where the stats can lie to us. And I don't think per possession stats are perfect either, because a possession in these leagues is all different. The opponents are different. The level of competition is different. There's a lot of factors. But we need to try to level the playing field where we can, even things out where we can, to evaluate players and prospects. And I think per possession stats are the way to do that, so you don't end up just overinflating the performance of players who play in a more stat-rich environment like the G League. And this is true for international prospects too. International teams play at all different pace levels. Different leagues play at different pace levels. And that can completely skew statistics, especially with some of these younger prospects who play such short periods of games on a lot of professional teams. So as we get this run up into the draft, as you're looking at that, make sure you're looking at what kind of stats you're being given for players. And when you're looking at them yourselves, make sure you're looking at complete seasons from players, and do your best to be able to find pace-free stats so you can have the opportunity to be able to understand how good a player is relative to others.
And Matt, do you have any content coming up? I know this is your busiest time of season. Is there anything we should be watching out for at this point?
Yeah, so we've got a regular release schedule over at my Patreon. If you're watching on YouTube, it's up there on the screen, patreon.com/NBA Dynasty ADP. I just released new Dynasty rankings in the last week, and also just released my updated trade calculator for both points and categories leagues. The Dynasty rankings are, there's tabs for both points and categories leagues as well. Working on the next release of my big board, my last one that I released, I believe, right before the NCAA tournament, had 50 players with fantasy stat projections, advanced statistics, per possession statistics, like we just talked about. That's a great way to be able to get caught up on the draft and get my perspective on it. I'll have a new version of that coming out in the next couple of weeks. So we're going to keep moving forward. I also put out a preview board for all 30 teams of minutes projections and rotation projections for the upcoming season a little bit earlier this year, that you could take a look at to be able to get an idea of where the big opportunities for minutes and breakout performances could be. So a lot going on. I'm excited that we're into Dynasty season, and I really appreciated the chance to be able to talk with you about it today, Noah.
Absolutely. Thank you for coming on to join me. You can follow Matt at NBA Dynasty ADP on Twitter. But that is going to do it for this episode of the Tank Me Later podcast.
You just listened to another episode from the Fantasy Basketball International Podcast Network. Thanks for joining us. And for more information about joining our community, please check out our website at fbibasketball.com.